Chapter 31. Spending the Surplus. The Common Sense Party's first major policy reversal of perceived current wisdom was with the scrapping of performance targets, league standings, and the attempt to make subtle human problems into figures on a graph that could be solved quickly and easily through initiatives. Arguing that important bodies such as the health service should have the emphasis on care and not on administration, the Common Sense Party forced through legislation that essentially argued, if it takes us 10 years to get into the shit, it will take us 20 to get out. And that journey starts now. We stayed at Mum's for dinner. Although dinner, in this context, might best be described as a loose collection of foodstuffs tossed randomly into a large saucepan and then boiled for as long as it took for all the taste to vanish, never to return. Because of this, we missed Redmond Vanderpost's address to the nation, something that didn't really trouble us, as the last address had been, as they always were, unbelievably dreary but astute and of vital importance. It was just so good to talk to Friday again, one to one. I'd forgotten how pleasant he actually was. He lost no time in telling me that he was going to have to stay undercover as a lazy good-for-nothing until the Chrono Guard had ceased operations, and this meant that I shouldn't even attempt to wake him until at least midday, or two on weekends. How convenient, I observed. Tuesday had been thoughtful for some time, and finally asked, "But can't the Chrono Guard go back to the time between when Great-Uncle Mycroft wrote the recipe and when he left it on the Hesperus?" "Don't worry," said Friday with a wink. "It was only 28 minutes, and the older me has it covered at the other end. The only thing we have to do is make sure the recipe stays in the wreck of the Hesperus. We can win this fight with nothing more than inaction, which as a teenager suits me just fine." It was only as we were driving home that I suddenly thought of Jenny. "Oh, my God," I said in a panic. "We left Jenny at home on her own." Landon took hold of my arm and squeezed it, and I felt Friday rest his hand on my shoulder.
"It's all right, darling. Calm down," Landon soothed. "We left her with Mrs. Burko Boiler."
I frowned. "No, we didn't. You said she was making a camp in the attic. We came straight out. How could we have forgotten?"
"Sweetheart," said Landon with a deep breath, "there is no Jenny."
"What do you mean?" I demanded, chuckling at the stupidity of his comment. "Of course there's a Jenny."
"Dad's right," said Friday soothingly. "There has never been a Jenny."
"But I can remember her." "It's Aornis, Mum," added Tuesday. "She gave you this mindworm 7 years ago, and we can't get rid of it." "I don't understand," I said, beginning to panic. "I can remember everything about her. Her laugh, the holidays, the time she fell off her bicycle and broke her arm, her birth, everything."
"Aornis did this to you for revenge," said Landon. "After she couldn't wipe me from your memory, she left you with this. That's what she's doing her 40-year stretch for."
"Bitch!" I yelled. "I'll kill her for this."
"Language, Mum," said Tuesday. "I'm only 12. Besides, even if you did kill her, we think Jenny would still be with you."
"Oh, shit," I said, as reason started to replace confusion and anger. "That's why she never turns up at meal times."
"We pretend there is a Jenny to minimize the onset of an attack," said Landon. "It's why we keep her bedroom as it is, and why you'll find her stuff all around the house. So when you're alone, you don't go into a missing daughter panic."
"The evil little cow," I muttered, rubbing my face. "But now that I know, we can do something about it, right?"
"It's not as easy as that, sweetheart," said Landon, with a note of sadness in his voice. "Aornis is truly vindictive. In a few minutes, you won't remember any of this, and you'll again believe that you have a daughter named Jenny."
"You mean," I said slowly, "I've done this before?" We pulled up outside the house, and Landon turned off the engine. There was silence in the car.
Sometimes you can go weeks without an attack, said Landon quietly. At other times, you can have two or three an hour.
Is that why you work from home?
Yeah. We can't have you going to school every day expecting to pick up a daughter who isn't there.
So, you've explained all this to me before?
Many times, darling.
I sighed deeply. I feel like a complete twit, I said in a soft voice. Is this my first attack today?
It's the third, said Landon. It's been a bad week.
I looked at them all in turn, and they were all staring back at me with such a sense of loving concern for my well-being that I burst into tears. It's all right, Mum, said Tuesday, holding my hand. We'll look after you. You're the best, most loving, supportive family anyone could ever have, I said through my sobs. I'm so sorry if I'm a burden. They all told me not to be so bloody silly. I told them not to swear. Then Landon gave me his handkerchief for my tears. So, I said, wiping my eyes. How does it work? How do I stop remembering the fact that there's no Jenny?
We have our ways. Jenny's at a sleepover with Ingrid, okay?
Okay. He leaned across and kissed me, smiled, and said to the kids, Right, team, do your stuff. Friday poked Tuesday hard in the ribs and she squealed. What was that for?
For being a geek.
I'd rather be a geek than a dur brain. And what's more, strontium goat is rubbish, and Wayne Skunk couldn't play a guitar if his life depended on it.
Say that again.
Will you two cut it out? I said crossly. Honestly, I think Friday's proved he's no dur brain over the short now thing, so just pack it in. Right. I know your gran gave us some food, but does anyone want anything proper to eat?
There's some pizza in the freezer, said Landon. We can have that.
We all got out of the car and walked up to the house, with Friday and Tuesday bickering.
Geek.
Dur brain.
Geek.
Dur brain. I said cut it out. I suddenly thought of something. Land, where's Jenny?
At a sleepover with Ingrid.
Oh, yeah. Again?
Thick as thieves, those two.
Yeah, I said with a frown. Thick as thieves, those two. Bowden called during dinner. This was unusual for him, but not totally unexpected. Spike and I had crept away from Acme like naughty school kids, as we didn't want to get into trouble over the cost of Major Pickles's carpet, not to mention that it had taken us both all day and we'd done nothing else. It's not great, is it? Said Bowden, in the over-serious tone he used when he was annoyed, upset, or angry. To be honest, I had the most shares in Acme, but he was the managing director, so day-to-day operations were up to him. I don't think it's all that bad, I said, going on the defensive.
Are you insane? Replied Bowden. It's a disaster.
We've had bigger problems, I said, beginning to get annoyed. I think it's best to keep a sense of proportion, don't you?
Well, yes, he replied. But if we let this sort of thing take a hold, you never know where it might end up.
I was pissed off now. Bowden, I said, just cool it. Spike got stuck to the ceiling by Raum, and if Pickles hadn't given the demi-devil the cold steel, we'd both be pushing up daisies. There was silence on the line for a moment, until Bowden said in a quiet voice, I'm talking about Vanderpost's address to the nation. What are you talking about? Oh, nothing. What did he say? Switch on the telly and you'll see. I asked Tuesday to switch channels. Owl TV was airing the popular current affairs show, Fresh Air, with Tudor Webberstow. And Tudor, who was perhaps not the best, but certainly the tallest reporter on TV, was interviewing the Common Sense Minister of Culture, Cherry Yogurt, MP. And the first classic to be turned into a reality book show? Pride and Prejudice, announced Yogurt proudly. It will be renamed The Bennets, and will be serialized live in your household copy the day after tomorrow.
Set in starchy early 19th century England, the series will feature Mr. and Mrs. Bennet and their 5 daughters being given tasks and then voted out of the house one by one, with the winner going on to a feature in Northanger Abbey, which itself will be the subject of more reader-active changes.
So, what Vanderpost is sanctioning, remarked Webberstow slowly, is the wholesale plunder of everything the literary world holds dear.
Not everything, corrected Miss Yogurt. Only books penned by English authors. We don't have the right to do dumb things with other nations' books. They can do that for themselves. But, she went on, I think plunder would be too strong a word. We would prefer to obfuscate the issue by using nonsensical jargon such as market-led changes or user choice enhancements. For centuries now, the classics have been dreary, overlong, and incomprehensible to anyone without a university education. Reality book shows are the way forward, and the Interactive Book Council are the people to do it for us. Am I hearing this right?
Unfortunately, murmured Landon, who was standing next to me.
We have been suffering under the yoke of the Stalinist principle of one-author books, continued Ms. Yogurt. And in the modern world, we must strive to bring democracy to the writing process.
I don't think any authors would regard their writing process as creative totalitarianism, said Webberstow uneasily. But we'll move on. As I understand it, the technology that will enable you to alter the storyline of a book will change it permanently, and in every known copy. Do you not think it would be prudent to leave the originals as they are and write alternative versions?
Yogurt smiled at him patronizingly. If we did that, she replied, it would barely be stupid at all. And the Common Sense Party takes the stupidity surplus problem extremely seriously. Prime Minister Vanderpost has pledged to not only reduce the current surplus to zero within a year, but to also cut all idiocy emissions by 70% in 2020. This requires unpopular decisions, and he had to compare the interests of a few die-hard elitist, dweeby, bespectacled book fans with those of the general voting public. Better still, because this idea is so idiotic that the loss of a single classic, say, Jane Eyre, will offset the entire nation's stupidity for an entire year. Since we have the potential to overwrite all the English classics to reader choice, we can do really stupid things with impunity. Who knows? We may even run a stupidity deficit, and can then afford to take on other nations' idiocy at huge national profit. We see the UK as leading the stupidity offset trading industry, and the idiocy of that idea will simply be offset against the annihilation of Vanity Fair. Simple, isn't it?
I realized I was still holding the phone. Bowden, are you there? I'm here.
This stinks to high heaven. Can you find out something about this so-called Interactive Book Council? I've never heard of such a thing. Call me back.
I returned my attention to the TV. And when we've lost all the classics and the stupidity surplus has once again ballooned? Asked Webberstow. What happens then?
Well, said Ms. Yogurt, with a shrug, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, eh?
You'll forgive me for saying this, said Webberstow, looking over his glasses, but this is the most harebrained piece of unadulterated stupidity that any government has ever undertaken, anywhere.
Thank you very much, replied Ms. Yogurt courteously. I'll make sure your compliments are forwarded to Prime Minister Vanderpost.
The programme changed to a report on how the interactive book might work. Something about new technologies and user-defined narrative. It was all baloney. I knew what was going on. It was Senator Jobsworth. He'd pushed through that interactive book project of Baxter's. Worse, he'd planned this all along. Witness the large throughput conduits in Pride and Prejudice and the recent upgrading of all Austen's work. I wasn't that concerned with how they'd managed to overturn my veto or even open an office in the real world. What worried me was that I needed to be in the book world to stop the nation's entire literary heritage from being sacrificed on the altar of popularism. The phone rang. It was Bowden again.
I made a trifling and wholly unbelievable excuse about looking for a hammer, then vanished into the garage so Landon couldn't hear the conversation.
The Interactive Book Council is run out of an office in West London, Bowden reported when I was safely perched on the lawnmower. It was incorporated a month ago and has the capacity to take 1,000 simultaneous calls, yet the office itself is barely larger than the one at Acme.
They must have figured a way to transfer the calls en masse to the book world, I replied. I'm sure 1,000 Mrs. Danvers would be overjoyed to be working in a call center rather than bullying characters or dealing with rampant misspellings. I told Bowden I'd try to think of something and hung up. I stepped out of the garage and went back into the living room, my heart thumping. This was why I had the veto, to protect the book world from the stupefying short-sighted decisions of the Council of Genres. But first things first, I had to contact Bradshaw and see what kind of reaction Juris Fiction was having to the wholesale slaughter of literary treasures. But how? Juris Tech had never devised a two-way communication link between the book world and the Outland, as I was the only one ever likely to use it.
"You all right, Mum?" asked Tuesday.
"Yes, Poppet, I'm fine," I said, tousling her hair. "I've just got to muse on this for a while." I went upstairs to my office, which had been converted from the old box room, and sat down to think. The more I thought, the worse things looked. If the CFG had discounted my veto and forced the interactivity issue, it was entirely possible that they would also be attacking Speedy Muffler and Racy Novel. The only agency able to police these matters was Juris Fiction, but it worked to text Grand Central's orders, which was, itself, under the control of the Council of Genres. So Jobsworth was ultimately in command of Juris Fiction, and he could do with that what he wanted. I sighed, leaned forward, and absently pulled out my hair tie, then rubbed at my scalp with my fingertips. Commander Bradshaw would never have agreed to this interactivity garbage, and would resign out of principle, as he had hundreds of times before. And if I were there, I could reaffirm my veto. It was a right given to me by the great Panjandrum, and not even Jobsworth would go against her will. This was all well and good, but for one thing. I'd never even considered the possibility of losing my travel book, so I'd never worked out an emergency strategy for getting into the book world without it. The only person I knew who could book jump without a book was Mrs. Nakajima, and she was in retirement at Thornfield Hall. Ex-Juris Fiction agent Harris Tweed had been banished permanently to the Outland, and without his travel book, he was as marooned as I was. Ex-Chancellor Yorick Kane, real these days and currently licking his wounds from a cell at Parkhurst, was no help at all. And neither was the only other fictionaut I knew still living, Cliff Hanger. I thought again about Commander Bradshaw. He'd certainly want me to contact him, and was a man of formidable resources. If I were him, how would I go about contacting someone in the real world? I checked my emails, but found nothing, and looked to see if I had any messages on my cell phone, which I hadn't. My mobile footnotophone, naturally, was devoid of a signal. I leaned back in my chair to think more clearly, and let my eyes wander around the room. I had a good collection of books, amassed during my long career as a literary detective. Major and minor classics, but little of any great value. I stopped and thought for a moment, then started to rummage through my bookshelf until I found what I was looking for. One of Commander Bradshaw's novels. Not one he wrote, of course, but one of the ones that featured him. There were 23 in the series, written between 1888 and 1922, and all featured Bradshaw either shooting large animals, finding lost civilizations, or stopping Johnny Foreigner from causing mischief in British East Africa. He had been out of print for over 60 years, and hadn't been read at all for more than 10. Since no one was reading him, he could say what he wanted in his own books,
and I would be able to read what he said. But there were a few problems. One, that 23 books would take a lot of reading. Two, that Text Grand Central would know if his books were being read. And three, that it was simply a one-way conduit. And if he did leave a message, he would never know if it was me who'd read it. I opened 2 Years Amongst the Umpopo and flicked through the pages to see if anything caught my eye, such as a double line space or something. It didn't. So I picked up Tilapia, the Devil Fish of Lake Rudolph, and after that, The Man-Eaters of Nakuru. It was only while I was idly thumbing through Bradshaw Defies the Kaiser that I hit pay dirt. The text of the book remained unaltered, but the dedication had changed. Bradshaw was smart. Only a variance in the story would be noticed at Text Grand Central. They wouldn't know I was reading it at all. I took the book back to my desk and read,
"Thursday, dear girl. If you can read this, you have realized that something is seriously squiffy in the book world. Plans had been afoot for weeks, and none of us had seen them. Thursday 1 through 4, yes, it's true, has taken your place as the C of G's LBOCS and is rubber-stamping all of Jobsworth's idiotic schemes. The interactivity idea is going ahead full speed, and even now Danver clones are massing on the borders of Racy Novel, ready to invade. Evil Thursday has loaded Text Grand Central with her toadies in order to keep a careful watch for any textual anomalies that might give them, or her, a clue as to whether you have returned. For it is this that Evil Thursday fears more than anything, that you will return, unmask her as an impostor, and retake your place. She has suspended jurisdiction and had all agents confined to their books, and she now commands a legion of Danver clones who are waiting to capture you should you appear in the book world. We stole back your travel book and have left it for you with Captain Carver. Inside, it was a dark and stormy night. If you can somehow find a way in. This dedication will self-erase in 2 readings. Good luck, old girl, and Melanie sends her love. Bradshaw."
I read the dedication again and watched as the words slowly dissolved from the page. Good old Bradshaw. I had been to It Was a Dark and Stormy Night a couple of times, mostly for training. It was a maritime adventure set aboard a tramp steamer on the Tasman Sea in 1924. It was a good choice, because it came under the deregulated area of the library known as Vanity Publishing. Text Grand Central wouldn't even know I was there. I replaced Bradshaw Defies the Kaiser on the shelf, then unlocked the bottom drawer and took out my pistol and eraser head cartridges. I stuffed them in my bag, noted that it was almost 10, and knocked on Friday's door.
"Darling?"
He looked up from the copy of Strontmania he was reading.
"Yeah?"
"I'm sorry, sweet pea, but I have to go back to the book world. It may put the unscrambled eggs recipe in jeopardy." He sighed and stared at me.
"I knew you would."
"How?" He beckoned me to the window and pointed to 3 figures sitting on a wall opposite the house.
"The one in the middle is the other me. It shows there is still a chance they'll get hold of the recipe. If we'd won, they'd be long gone."
"Don't worry," I said, laying a hand on his. "I know how important the length of the now is to all of us. I won't go anywhere near the wreck of the Hesperus."
"Mum," he said in a quiet voice, "if you get back home and I'm polite, well-mannered, and with short hair, don't be too hard on me, eh?"
He was worried about being replaced. "It won't come to that, sweet pea. I'll defend your right to be smelly and uncommunicative with my life." We hugged, and I said goodbye, then did the same to Tuesday, who was reading in bed, giggling over the risible imperfections of The Special Theory of Relativity. She knew I was going somewhere serious, so she got out of bed to give me an extra hug just in case. I hugged her back, tucked her in, told her not to make Einstein look too much of a clot, in case it made her look cocky. I then went to say goodbye to Jenny, and can remember doing so,
although for some reason Friday and Tuesday picked that moment to argue about the brightness of the hall light. After sorting them out, I went downstairs to Landon. "Land," I said, unsure of what to say, since I rarely got emergency call-outs for carpet laying, and to pretend I did now would be such an obvious lie. "You do know I love you."
"More than you realize, sweetheart."
"And you trust me?"
"Of course."
"Good. I've got to go and..."
"Do some emergency carpet laying?"
I smiled. "Yeah. Wish me luck." We hugged. I put on my jacket and left the house, hailing a cab to take me to the Clary Lamar travel port. When I was safely on the bullet train to Saknussemm, I took out my cell phone and keyed in a number. I stared out at the dark Wessex countryside that zipped past so fast the few street lamps I could see were almost orange streaks. The cell was picked up, and I paused, heart thumping, before speaking. "My name's Thursday next. I'd like to speak to John Henry Goliath." "You're going to have to wake him. It's a matter of some importance."